Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome, and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello and welcome to the International Schools Podcast. Delighted to be recording the first episode with my good friend, John Micton. I'm recording this from Prague, from the Apps Events HQ. It's beautiful sunny weather. We're recording this on Monday the 3rd of July. The weather kind of changed, and we actually had a big brunch and a big party yesterday at the house, which was nice. So John is on the line from Luxembourg. And what's the weather like in Luxembourg right now?
Hot and muggy.
Right. I guess, yeah. If you're in the inner city, being hot is not always as enjoyable. We're in the countryside now where we live, you know. Now, I actually appreciate the heat more than when I was living in Prague.
Yeah, I bet. No. It looks like it's going to storm, and we had 30 degrees this weekend. So I think everybody's just waiting for the skies to break open.
Great. So just as an introduction, I've known John, I think we figured out it was since 2010. 2010 was the first time we met. It's now 2019, so 9 years. So, and I met John when he was teaching in Prague at International School of Prague, and we ran together the first ever Google Education Conference, or we called it a summit, in Europe, the first ever one in Europe. There was a few in the US, nothing outside, which was great. But actually before that, we did a Google Workshop for Educators, a smaller event, which was the really first event.
Yeah.
Since then, John's been in Switzerland and Luxembourg, but I want to just get to a bit of just John's background, because it's fascinating. John's like had the proper, like the old school international school teacher educator experience. So John, do you want to go through a bit of like how you got started working for schools and where your travels have taken you?
Yeah. So I originally started in the advertising industry. I worked for television and newspapers in the United States, and then was working in Japan. And on some traveling, we connected with an international school administrator just socially. And then I kind of discovered the world of international schools, and it seemed quite intriguing.
That was somebody in Singapore, wasn't it? So you met someone
Yes, at the Singapore American School.
Yep.
And then went back to the United States and was kind of deciding. I actually went back to Switzerland, to my home, and then was deciding what I want to do with my life. And then I start thinking about maybe education being something. And then I went through a UCLA program that was encouraging people from industry and non-education backgrounds to consider going into education. And to cut a long story short, my wife and I went for an interview up in San Francisco, and our first job was at the International School of Tanganyika. And then we were at the Western Academy of Beijing, the American School in Japan, International School of Prague, and Intercommunity School of Zurich, and now here in Luxembourg. And I had done some subbing at the International School of Geneva. So, yeah, so quite a few different schools, and always worked in education technology, and then started also being part of the senior leadership team. So, and then I always try to teach a bit. So here in Luxembourg, I teach an ethics class. We call it Digital X. So I get to have one group of grade six every year that I work with, which is really good. Gives me, you know, keeps me, as they say, honest and my feet burning from the realities of being in the classroom.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, I got asked to help out with one of the schools here on the business management IB diploma program, which I'm looking into at the moment. If I can spare the time, I'm going to help out. So I want to talk to Tiffany about that. Yeah, I won't mention the school because it's not agreed yet, but I'm really interested in that topic, you know. So for me, it's fascinating. Hey, interesting. You see, your first job was in Tanzania. Now, how did you get started? Like, what did you do in your first job?
So my first job, I actually started as a grade three teacher, and they had a small Mac lab.
Oh, really? Because I always know you as a tech director, so you didn't start off in the kind of IT track.
Actually, my first job was teaching kindergarten and preschool.
Wow.
And then in Tanzania, as a grade three teacher, the little lab needed a lot of work. I got involved. And having come from a background in newspapers and television, always had been exposed to a lot of technology and, you know, editing and things like that. So I just gravitated and...
Can you tell us, I know you had a really good story about what the technology was like back then in Tanzania. Didn't you have to you had one computer, you managed to get one internet connection somehow, like Jerry
Rigger? That's right. So we had very little internet. It was very unreliable. This is in 93, so you can imagine in Tanzania, the infrastructure was not great. But we had an IBM machine, and teachers would go ahead and write their emails on a floppy disk, and then we would drive up to the University of Dar es Salaam that had the kind of connection to the world, and they would send the emails out, and then 7 days later, we would come back, collect the floppy, and bring it back to the teachers, and then they would read their emails, respond, and then we'd do that again. And that was really at the beginnings, and now, well, as you know, in Africa, what happened is mobile networks came, and they quickly jumped quite quickly from what I would say a very disadvantaged situation to everything mobile. So this was really at the beginning, and we at that time were doing very little things on the internet. Everything was local area.
And did you by the time you left, did you have the internet there?
By the time I left, we did have the internet, but not in the classroom or in the labs.
Yeah,
it's really still very dedicated lines.
Yeah, I had a great experience. I went down, we ran a summit. We've run two events there, actually, at the school.
That's right.
And I had a really great time. You fly down. It's a really nice school. It's very, it's kind of built around some nice kind of gardens. It's very green and open air, you know. And
beautiful campus.
And really, just really interesting. We actually just got contacted by the International School of Dar es Salaam. Just talking to them tomorrow out of interest, just to... Okay. School I've got no experience of, but they're interested in hosting an event as well.
No, I think, and especially in the 90s, you know, a lot of issues had to do with just basic connectivity. And when I was at the Western Academy of Beijing, you know, a different political dynamic and far much more controlled about internet. And we did get an internet, and we got in the science labs. But you forget, you know, nowadays we just, it's ubiquitous and seamless, and we just assume it's everywhere. And if it doesn't work, we scream. But I think for a lot of educators that started in the 90s and 2000s, there were a lot of challenges. And I think especially for fellow international school educators in Africa and tech directors, it's always been, you know, the challenges of connectivity, reliability, and those things always bring an extra component of creative tensions as you try to solve those problems, which often is good. You know, I think adversity brings out a lot of innovation.
Yeah, definitely constraints. What's the quote about constraints?
Yeah.
Something to do with creativity. What did the transition look like in terms of your career, like from... I didn't actually know this, but you started off as a kindergarten and early years teacher. Like, how did that transition gradually come from you to be a tech director? Did it over a few jobs, or did you just gradually teach less and less, or did you jump into it?
So at the Western Academy of Beijing, they were looking for somebody to kind of coordinate everything.
Right.
So I coordinated the IT throughout, but taught at the same time. Often it's about just somebody that can manage the different workflows and also maybe can help with supporting teachers to build on the vision. And having worked in sales and also in the newspaper industry, I had a lot of training and exposure to working with teams and getting people to work on ideas and then make them into actual actions. So I had a bit of experience, and I think I just kind of organically gravitated to that. And then when I came to Prague, actually, that was my first full-time admin job where I was not teaching anymore. In Japan, I was doing coordination and teaching and at WAB too. And then in Zurich and here, it's been the same. But I always think, you know, one of the things that I always, and it's easier said than done, is always try to keep being in the classroom, because you know there's that distance, what they call the abundance gap. You know, the more you're disconnected, the more sometimes you don't understand some of the tensions and challenges that people have. So I always try to make sure that I'm teaching at some level, so sure. I really get a sense of, you know, the systems that you put in, if they work or not. There's only way of finding out is actually using them as a regular user.
Must be tough though, like you're about to kick off a lesson, or you're in the middle of teaching a lesson and someone charges in, oh, the internet's down, this is going down, you know.
Yeah,
that's got to be a hard thing to manage.
And what's interesting is, because definitely in China, we would always have a plan B. People pretty much designed their lessons with a plan B. We had the internet, but we knew sometimes it would be turned off, or there were, you know, infrastructure problems. And then when I was in Japan, we had a T3 line, and things were just seamless, and people were less prone to get a plan B. And then when I was in Prague a couple times, we had some issues as we were developing our Wi-Fi network and really building it up as we brought on one-to-one. And as you do, you know, there's this whole back infrastructure that also has to come into play. And I remember a teacher saying, I don't have a plan B anymore. This is 2000 and something, you know.
Yeah.
We don't have, you know, we need the internet. It's a non-negotiable. And I think that's what's become really interesting. It's become so much a non-negotiable. Not that you need to have it to be a good teacher, but we tend to gravitate and really understand the power of that tool and how that gives us opportunities to engage kids authentically and do things maybe that we weren't able to do before, really kind of this idea of revisioning. So I think it's interesting that people now just assume, and when it doesn't work, it's far bigger issue. Maybe you have less resilience for it not working.
I mean, I think it's like modern life, isn't it? People just freak out if they haven't got internet. Well, people freak out about, I think, you know what, this is a bigger picture of, like, you can see in the Western world now, things are sort of so convenient, but if people don't get there, like if their Uber's 2 minutes late, they're just freaking out. And if like their Starbucks, you know, isn't quite right, they're freaking out. And it's like all these like amazing things that 10 years ago you didn't have, which are now like, you know, they stress you out when you don't come. It's kind of some dichotomy of like modern life, when everything becomes more convenient, people get more annoyed when it's not there, you know.
Yeah, you know, Barry Schwartz from Harvard says it's the paradox of choice. We have too much choice, and we just expect it now. And it's, you know, you go to your hotel and they say the Wi-Fi is down. It's like somebody has just, like, you know, tried to murder you or something.
Yeah.
You know, and now you even hear of resorts where you pay a premium so you don't get Wi-Fi, so you're really disconnected. I mean, that's how kind of the absurdity of things have come about, is that you pay extra not to be connected.
Yeah, the digital detox. It's funny, you know, every time, I'm so connected all the time, and every time I get on a long flight, I actually love the fact there's no internet. I mean, I hate this idea of Wi-Fi on planes, because that's the time I can read, watch a film, have a glass
exactly.
of wine. I just turn my brain off, you know?
Yeah, but now all the planes have it, you know? And yeah. I was actually on a flight this spring, and the airline, because there had been some problem at the first hour, they then gave it free to everybody. I was like, oh no, not that.
Yeah,
I was planning to watch all these movies, and now it's like notifications are coming in. Yeah.
Interesting. So, John, I want to, before we get into, we're going to talk a bit about digital citizenship, because that's something you and me talk about a lot. But before that, I want to just, everyone who comes on, I want to just talk about where they are now and kind of get a flavor of it. So you're in Luxembourg. I've obviously seen you there. I've been around to your apartment. You live kind of very central. You work for a school that's central. Like, how would you describe it as a place to live, both for international school teachers and anyone who might be interested to think about going there?
Well, I Luxembourg is a very interesting country because it's very small, but it also is quite wealthy.
Yep.
So I think that combination
expensive
was
as well.
Always intriguing. It's expensive, but not as expensive as, you know, a lot of big cities. You know, I often I like to call it the best kept secret in Europe because it's a small city that acts like a big city.
Yeah.
So a lot of culture, a lot of music. There's a lot going on. The government is really investing a lot in digital technology and services. You know, they're working with free public transport. There's, you know, the medical system is very robust. It's really, I think, a very interesting place. I think if you come from a big Asian city or a big South American city, it's going to feel like you've come to a country town.
Yeah.
And maybe doesn't have the dynamism. But I think there's a lot to offer and there are a lot of opportunities. And I think for myself in my position, I've been, you know, starting to work with the Luxembourg Ministry of Education, doing some training and being involved in some of that work. And I've been really impressed how a small country has really taken on what they call Digital Luxembourg, taken on that whole thing as an urgent matter to engage with. And they're doing a lot of work. So for me, it's been interesting because there's this other narrative going on is a small country has decided they want to be the most connected and the best equipped to service this digital world that we live in. So I think, you know, for people in this industry, it's interesting. And I think there are a lot of opportunities.
It's interesting. Like my take on it was, first of all, it was really picturesque. I liked the nightlife. We had went to a great Italian restaurant and some good bars. I liked it. The old town's really beautiful. I met a few people there and it seems like if I'm going to compare it to Prague, for instance, it's a strange comparison, but like everyone there, like, pretty much worked for a bank or a consultancy. Like they had a good job. Like it didn't seem to me like, whereas in Prague, I reckon more than half of my friends are kind of entrepreneurs or people doing some kind of, you know, interesting thing. I think there people have good jobs. It's not a much, doesn't seem like there's a lot of foreigners there doing entrepreneurial things. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think there are, but not at the level where, you know, fintech, financial technology, banking, a lot of Amazon, Skype, eBay, all those big companies are there because of the tax rebates and the way the tax structure. I think, I know, having been to a few events, is that they want to push that startup, kind of tech startup.
Yeah.
But I think one of the issues that they're facing is manpower and just skill set.
Yeah.
There are just not enough people. And so I know the government is really trying to change that. I think it's definitely doesn't have the buzz of maybe, say, Prague or some of the other cities around the world or even, you know, Zurich, where there are more startups, but there are more and more. But I think so often they're overshadowed by these jobs, you know, like the Deloittes and the PwCs, these big corporations that have set themselves up. So I think you're right. There's a lot of people earning good incomes in what I would say in more traditional corporate type of situations. But there is a budding startup economy, but I think it's not as obvious or out there. But I think there's definitely a consecrated effort by the government and people to, you know, look at those opportunities here.
Yeah, definitely. What's it like in terms of international schools? Like how many schools are there?
So there are two St. George's, which is based on the British curriculum, and the International School of Luxembourg, which is our school, which is based on the IB and IGCSE. What's interesting is the Luxembourg government is starting to open its own English-speaking PYP, MYP, and IB schools in the public school system because they understand, because there's such a large influx of expatriates and companies that are trying to make it attractive for people to move here, they started opening. And so ironically, some of our competition is international schools, but in the public school system, which is interesting because the public school system is free.
Yep.
So that's a different dynamic for an international school like ourselves that's paying to have that kind of creative tension of other schools being there.
Yeah. What's it like in terms of the social life of people working at schools? Is it one of these cases where people kind of socialize within the kind of context at their own school pretty much? Or is there much of a case of people getting out and meeting each other?
I think, you know, because it's so easy and people live in apartments and not in compounds and it's pretty much, you know, very infrastructure, administration, all those things that often can take time in a different context. Say if you're in Africa or in Asia where maybe there's a bigger language barrier or the infrastructure and the administration is more complicated, people tend to make their own lives in the local communities here.
Yeah.
So I think in the school, it's not – I remember in Tanzania, we all lived in a compound, and in China too. And there was a really strong kind of social network within the school because that was it. So I think here it's much more people go in – get involved in local community, because in Luxembourg, everybody speaks English, French, and German in Luxembourgish. So I don't think there is many challenges sometimes to find your own little space to have your own social life.
Fascinating, fascinating. So what about you, John? Do you think you will ever head back to Asia or Africa, or you think you're going to stay in Europe now?
I have no idea. But right now I'm in Europe and I'm really enjoying it. And having been in Asia for 14 years, this was just a good time to come back.
Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying being part of this, you know, the European community of international schools. And yeah, I'm you know, it's more the job than the location. I always, when people say, oh, I want to go to this country and teach, I always say, pick the school first. You know, it's move for the school, not the country. Because you're going to spend more time in the school than in the country.
That's exactly right. I think that's a great point. Now, Asia for me, I mean, as you know, I'm a huge Asia fan. I'm actually, I don't know if I've told you, I've got this plan. I really want my son to learn Chinese. We're going to have 2 months out there this year. And I'm even thinking of spending a year or two out in Taiwan. I've got some great friends there. It's a beautiful country, Mandarin speaking, and he could go to preschool there before he goes to regular school. You know, I don't know. It's just an idea now, but my wife's quite into
Mandarin
the plan.
Mandarin would not be a bad thing.
Yeah, well, it's going to be. I mean, we're entering. There was a really good Economist article a couple of weeks ago about, you know, sometime in the next 10, 15 years, we're already entering the Asian century. I mean, and this kind of current blip in U.S.-China relations is just a blip. It's inevitable. You know that it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think the sustainability of the Chinese model is much stronger than what maybe America is facing right now with the polarization. And, you know, the reality is it's, you know, 1 billion people. Yeah. That's a huge market. So it's absolutely fascinating. And I think, you know, it's interesting because a lot of international schools, obviously the bigger market where the growth is, as you and I have actually talked previously, is, you know, the Asian schools are just growing. And so is the Middle East. And I'm not seeing many new international schools being built in Europe.
No, it's all Asia and the Middle East. I saw like two or three more. You know, there's a very popular model now of English public schools, which are basically private schools, kind of doing like a franchise model.
Like Harrow and Dulwich.
Yeah, exactly. Harrow and Dulwich, they've been there for a while, but there's a few others. I saw in Bangkok, King's College School, Wimbledon's just opening. I know there's Shrewsbury School. Loads of them, and they're all doing it. And the way it seems to work is an interesting model of whereas like a local businessman will kind of effectively buy the rights to operate the school, and they'll have to do it to the same standard as a school in the UK, you know, and there's a lot of restrictions.
Ah.
But essentially, so I was curious who was behind Harrow School, and it's a local entrepreneur, and he's doing I think it's Shanghai and Bangkok and another place. So really interesting, and that seems to be the predominant, like how a lot of these schools are growing right now out there.
Yeah, and what another interesting thing is a lot of the growth is in the for-profit model more than the non-profit, which is the situation of my current school and all the schools that I've worked in that I mentioned are always non-profit.
Yeah, well, I guess when you started, that's what an international school was, wasn't it? It was a non-profit.
Yeah.
And now it's like 70% of international schools are for-profit now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a huge number. And that's an interesting dynamic because I think sometimes the focus and the pressures are very different than from a non-profit.
Yeah, I've worked with both, and sometimes it's difficult to tell, you know. If you get a good management team in the school, it's often you wouldn't know, you know. But it's a fascinating topic. But John, we want to talk a bit about digital citizenship today. That's a topic we talk about a lot, and a topic you know a lot about. You're always kind of my go-to person on the topic. I guess kicking off, like, why is it important? And I guess maybe could we start off, like, could you define, like, how you see what is digital citizenship? People that maybe don't know.
Yeah, I think digital citizenship is kind of the ethical responsibilities associated with using devices and social media and the internet. And, you know, if you take the word digital away and citizenship, many things that you're engaging with and trying to build capacity with kids is very similar, you know, being respectful, being kind, being, you know, not abusing the tool, also making sure you, if somebody else writes a story, that you honor the copyright. It's all those things that we would expect to happen in a non-digital world kind of transformed to the digital. But I think what has kind of muddied the waters is that as a society, we have become, with AI and devices, it's kind of accelerated. And now a lot of these tensions or creative tensions that are percolating into schools seem quite overwhelming, the idea of screen time. And parents coming in and saying, you know, you need to do something. I can't control my kid anymore. He's always or she's always on Fortnite or whatever it might be. Yeah. And I think schools now in some ways have, you know, a few years ago decided digital citizenship was something that we need to engage with. But I think it was engaged in a way where the tech coaches or the digital coaches would do a lesson, come into the classroom, do a lesson and then leave. And it was kind of more, you know, surgical strikes. And you know, other schools went with a more program-based view where they really made sure that the advisory programs or the homerooms, that there was, this was all happening. But what is happening now is that kids, a lot of these issues transcend being a digital citizenship class. They're in every class, they're in the corridors. And this idea of screen time and social media and the cyberbullying, you know, all that suddenly has exploded. And I think for a lot of parents and schools, it's about whose responsibility is it and how do we curate this in a way that we're supporting each other and we're actually addressing many of these issues that sometimes feel like, well, it has nothing to do with physics. But if my kids are unhappy and being stressed out because there's cyberbullying going on a WhatsApp group and they come into my class, well, maybe it is partly my responsibility, and is how do you define that?
It's interesting. The cyberbullying, that's a good place to start, because that's, I mean, that's clearly, if you're in a tech role at a school, that's something where you want to be controlled. And a lot of people use, you know, various backup tools to have control if they ever need to go back and look at all the emails of an incident so they can properly review it, because that's something that happens more and more often in schools now.
Yeah. And I think the issue is not so much what happens on the school networks, because I think many schools are quite good at keeping track and having a paper trail or what a digital trail of what kids do. It's when they come in with their phones and they have 4G and they do the WhatsApp or Snapchat. And that kind of behavior is taking place outside of school, but it's become a gray zone because they're on the school bus or during an activity. And now this all bleeds into each other. And then who really picks up the responsibility, and how do you work as a school to support parents? And also, what is your, where do you get involved and when do you stop? And I think what we're discovering is that it's really a relationship and a tight collaboration between the home, the school, and the students. And
how does that work from your side? Because I presume, like, you would get involved at the point when some student would say, would report it, you know, someone was doing something on WhatsApp on the school bus. Like, I guess at that point, once it's been reported, someone from the school has to kind of investigate it.
They do. But so often what happens is you get an email from a parent. They say, oh, my kids were at a sleepover and now they're on WhatsApp and there was this bad behavior. Here's some screenshots. And the school's thinking, okay, am I now monitoring screen time and sleepovers? Yeah. It's that. I don't think we've worked that out. And that's really for schools to decide strategically and philosophically where they stand. But I think for us in our current situation, we've really started to work. We have a digital life program, which is a parent workshop program. We're in our second year where we do 8 2-hour sessions over the year where we're doing a lot of hands-on activities. My digital coaches come in and show lessons that we're doing in class. And we've had our leadership team have an open forum with the parents about screen time. I think it's about making sure everybody's in the same room. We're all talking, all agreeing we need to support each other and together defining what, you know, who does what. But I think the most important is that we all agree this is an issue. We all agree we're collaboratively responsible and then decide how we're going to do this. But I think that is really messy.
Definitely. I mean, what you're saying is it's like you've got to work on the prevention rather than the cure. Because once it's happened, there's a limited what you can do. You can make someone apologize, or if it's really bad, there could be some kind of suspension. But like the only really way to deal with this is to try to make people not post that kind of thing in the first place.
Yeah, and Dana Boyd from Berkeley Internet research center in Harvard, who wrote this wonderful book, is called The Social Life of Network Teams, says these tools don't generate the bad behavior, the good behavior. They just amplify whatever's behind that screen.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of, I don't think adults are necessarily very good at this either. I mean, I see a lot of stuff on Instagram and Facebook, and I'm like, it's kind of insensitive. Like, you hear all the time about, like, when I speak to, like, my sister about her kids, like, there's bullying, which is kind of an obvious thing, but then there's a second level, which is there was a cool party and then certain people weren't invited and everyone's posting about it, and then their kids feel really bad because they're seeing all this on social media and they missed out. And adults do that as well. It kind of boggles my mind, but, you know, if I was at an event where maybe certain people for whatever reason weren't there, you know, I just wouldn't be posting it. Like, that's the whole kind of second level of misery it brings on people.
Well, these are really interesting what you're bringing up, and the Cyber Effect is a book, and one of the
Cyber
author, so the author Mary Akin is her name. And she's a forensic psychiatrist and specializes in the digital world. She says we adults shouldn't be asking when is the appropriate time to give a device to a young child. The question is, when is it the appropriate time for an adult to be on their device in front of a child?
That's a great point, because that's a concrete thing for me now. I'm trying not to be on the phone, because my son's almost a year, you know. I know he sees me and he tries to grab it, and I don't want him to see me on the phone all the time, you know.
And I think one of the things that I am struggling with is how, as school leaders and as schools, do we get to empower our teachers to understand that they have as much of a role in this conversation and in this work as the students? Because, you know, people say, well, the kids were on their phones during whatever activity or class, and then you have a faculty meeting and half the people are on their phones.
Yeah.
So let's kind of rewind and think of ourselves all in the same basket. And I think as adults, we have as much responsibility, and we struggle with it too.
Yeah.
You know, many of us go to bed with our phone and wake up with our phone, and we know that they're designed. I mean, the fact is, these things are designed to be addictive. It's a very explicit choreographing of this idea of variable rewards, where, you know, you never know if you're going to get a like, so you keep on checking and just in case. And I think this is really the challenge for schools, it's a collective responsibility. And what do we do to support teachers in giving them the professional development, the tools, and make sure that we're all invested in this? Because it's the fact is, these things aren't going to go away.
It's, you know, and it's interesting about the likes thing you mentioned, because, like, if you look at what people say and how they behave, if you take my friends, it's two very different things. Because everyone says, oh, I don't care about likes. I look down on these people. But if you look at how they behave, and how I'm as guilty as everyone of this. You make a post, it gets a lot of likes, you feel good about it. Oh, cool, I made some content, everyone likes this. Like, look at the likes coming in, and you think it's great. But if you hear people talk, it's like they're very zen, they don't care about it. You know, but it's just not true, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and I think also when you post and you get no likes, suddenly you're thinking, shit, sorry.
Exactly.
Should be swearing on the podcast. But
exactly.
You're thinking, you know, I'm not feeling good about myself. Why did they like this picture and not that picture?
Yeah.
And I think the other interesting thing is this whole sharenting thing. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No, tell me. I mean, I am, but let's talk about it on the podcast.
Sharenting is when parents post pictures of their kids without asking them.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And so, you know, and fair enough, but I am so happy we didn't have social media, because my kids would not be happy to see their fetus on Facebook.
Yeah.
And then their first steps. And it's amazing if you look at some of the social media. My question often is, what happens when you're 16 and you go back and look at your parents' Facebook, or there's a digital footprint of you that you're not in control of?
It's, you know what, like, it's so hard, because before I had a baby, I'm like, I'm never gonna, I can't believe people do all this crap. I'm never gonna do it. And then you have one, it's like, I want to post a picture, you know. But
of
actually, I keep it really minimal. I think I posted two ever, but it's really,
actually,
it's,
I haven't seen much from you. You've been really good, Dan.
I posted one when he was born, and then I think maybe just one.
There was a ski one, not
exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah, more on Instagram, because I've got a smaller group on Instagram. I guess I probably share more where there's a smaller group of connections,
yeah.
You know. But then again, I mean, when we get to the point of, if you look at what we, I mean, our generation of what we consider private and what young people do is that they have much less of a, well, it's all public anyway kind of attitude, you know, and that's probably going to change with the generation after, but that's how it seems to be now.
But I think it's because they look at privacy completely different than we do.
Yeah.
And we're trying to say, this is what we think privacy is. So we want to make sure you believe that and understand privacy in the context of our world. And I know that my daughter and son, who are in their 20s, they don't think of privacy like I do.
Yeah.
And they have their Instagram account, and then they have the other Instagram account, and they have Facebook for grandma and grandpa and mom and dad, but they have this other venue that is only for their very close. So I think, you know, we often are challenged, and we look at kids like they don't understand privacy. I think we have to understand that their point of reference is different, and what can we do to better understand that point of reference and contextualize it as we engage with them and the idea of privacy. And I mean, I think there are two levels of privacy. There's the privacy on social media, the Instagram, the Snapback. Then there's the whole privacy with the surveillance economy and the surveillance, you know, cameras and what happens when governments, and we see, you know, if you just read the newspapers, you see what happens in China with Xinjiang and those areas. And there's even a terrible story now in Brooklyn where this building is being gentrified and the African-American residents were singled out as being filmed and asked to sign a disclosure so they could put cameras in the hallways. So it becomes very complex and very 1984-ish. And I think that is a far more bigger issue that we should be addressing with kids than the fact that they've posted a stupid picture on Facebook.
Well, I mean, the China social credit, I don't know if you, how much you've been following, that's straight out
amazing.
Of 1984. And that's, yeah. And that's live. I mean, that's running now, you know? You can't, well, you can't get on a flight if you have a certain ranking, certain low social credit score. It's like boggles the mind.
It's sobering. And this year, during Chinese New Year, 23 million people were not able to take high-speed trains or flights because of their social credits.
Yeah, it's you know, it's interesting though. Some European countries have similar things. I remember I lived in Holland back in, when was it? Year 2000, and we were getting to Schiphol Airport. We went in, and I went back in those days. You know, you had a passport check. They checked you on the way out. They don't do it anymore. And the guy, my name popped up on the computer, and the guy was like, "Oh, you've got an outstanding electricity bill." And I was like, "Really?" And he's like, "Yeah, you." And I'm like, "Okay." And he's like, "Well, you've got to go and pay it, or you can't get on the flight." So even in Holland, even back then, if you had somehow certain utilities and local councils were linked in. I don't know if you knew this. Were linked into the airport, and they wouldn't let you on the plane unless you paid it.
That's pretty intense at that level already, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is 19 years ago, you know? Like, yeah, maybe so I was just really unlucky, I don't know.
So I think, you know, what you're talking about, Dan, is maybe the new level of digital citizenship. It's more a collective understanding that fundamental rights and this idea of free will, where you decide when you get to do things and not, and who gets to see what. And the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe has kind of been addressing that. But for me, that's what we should be talking to kids about.
Yeah.
Because they're going to go into jobs where they're going to be programming AI. They're going to be working in environments where they're making ethical decisions with third-party machines. And so I think, you know, the cyberbullying, the copyright are important, but I think there's even a bigger issue is this idea of the surveillance economy. And if I just make one thing, I think what we often do is we make the assumption that the kids are digital natives.
Yeah.
And they are natives, but what I always like to say, they're good digital consumers.
Sure.
They're very good at consuming it. But ask a kid to take their iPhone apart, or even an adult, and know how it works. I think that's where we have more experience and wisdom. And I always try to explain to teachers, as we're working with the team, the digital coaches and myself, is that you have that wisdom, you have that balance, you have that perspective. Kids don't have that. They have the consumption, but you bring something that they don't have and they will never have. That's your wisdom and knowledge and being the teacher and about balance and ethics and, you know, good morals and being nice to somebody and knowing how to balance things. I think that's why digital citizenship is still important, because these kids, in my view, are excellent consumers, but I'm not sure they have – the capacity pedagogically and age-wise to really digest that and be able to turn around with concrete strategies. I think teachers have that role still critical.
Definitely. The role is interesting, and it's come back to what you said about the a lot of students are actually consumers. They don't know as much as we think technically. It's an interesting, if I think back to say growing up, like my dad and pretty much all my friends' dads, I'm sure dad was the same. He could fix anything on the car. He'd have it up on blocks. He'd be changing the clutch. He could fix anything in the house. He could build furniture. He could do all these things. Like by the time he got to me, I can't do any of that. Like, it's embarrassing, really. But there's a certain group of people I know who can, but most people can't. But I got really into techie stuff. I was coding and I was working, and I was always a guy that could fix computers, and I was always a guy that could do all this sort of stuff. And it was like a whole niche kind of skill I had, which didn't exist in his generation, but the skills he had, I don't know how, so many of my friends have the same experience. I'm not sure how this kind of practical skills kind of got lost in kind of one generation, And then onto the current generation, I'm not sure what's changed again in that,
Yeah, and then you hear this whole idea of makerspaces. Let's give the hammers and let them...
Well, some certain students, there's a subset of students, aren't there, who are into the makerspaces who really can build things.
Yeah, but there's also, I think there's a general feeling that we need to bring that back, the hands-on, the tactile, the eye-to-hand coordination, We're definitely, I think, and I've talked to a fair amount of preschool teachers, they definitely notice a lot of younger kids, 3 to 4 years old, that, spend a lot of time on the iPad because in some contexts, it's a glorified babysitter, and it's much easier giving the kid the iPad
definitely.
Than having them have a tantrum.
Especially on a plane. You see that on the plane.
Yeah. Or you go into restaurants, and you see families that, the kids both have iPads. And, okay, I'm not here to judge, it's complicated being a parent. And, of course, there are a lot of things that sometimes the iPad's really nice. But I think, as schools, we need to understand there is a significant shift how the world is going to be, and devices and artificial intelligence and this idea of curation and surveillance, all those things are really important topics. And I think we need to understand there's a certain urgency, and what can we do as schools to make that part of our narrative and our professional development, and making sure teachers feel equipped to be engaging with these ideas and also feel that it connects to what they're able to do.
Yeah. Do you teach any, as part of any other subjects, any digital skills kind of classes at your school?
So we definitely do some of that. I think that's an area we feel, for a while there were the computer labs, and you went to the computer lab and you had computer time.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the laptops came about and everything was integrated in the classroom. I think what I'm noticing is some schools are saying, hold on, we need a lab for digital video editing, Logic Pro audio editing, because a lot of that more high-end, in-depth stuff you can't really do in an integrated model with a room of 20 laptops. I mean, you can, of course, engage with it and try to do it, but I think now there's a bit of a balance. Where are those digital skills like programming, coding? Where do you teach that? Is that integrated in the math class, or is it something that you pull kids out and really focus? So I think that's an interesting debate that's going on right now.
Definitely. Quick plug as well here, by the way. Google has this great program called Applied Digital Skills. If you just search for Google, Applied Digital Skills.
And it's a great e-newsletter. Definitely subscribe to it. It's fantastic.
And I don't know if I've mentioned this, John, so we're running a lot of these courses for Google. And basically, if someone's interested, we can come and present the course to your teachers at school completely free. It's like the best deal in the world. So just email me at dan@appsevents.com, appsevents.com. We didn't get in the UK, but we could do some schools outside. I'm pretty sure we could do that. And we're running these applied digital skills programs. It's a half day. We come in, work with a lot of teachers on teaching these skills, and really, really good program.
Excellent. That's great. And I think, that is, again, an example is, for a lot of teachers, it's a busy day and sometimes there's not the space and time. And what can we do to give more space and time for them to, be exposed to these digital skills? Because I know sometimes teachers come in and they have a room full of laptops and they just feel like, wow, how am I going to catch up with everybody? And I think it's not so much catching up, but giving strategies. How do you manage when kids are on devices and what are some good things to do and not, and what are some protocols you can engage kids with so you feel you have some control over things.
And really, like, it's tough to manage at a school level, I think, because every teacher is different. Some teachers will be like, devices, no devices in class, laptops are closed. Some teachers are very relaxed about it. You know, it's very hard to dictate one policy across all subject areas, you know.
I agree, but I think it's a non-negotiable that everybody should be able to know how to manage a device and know how to have balance with it. That's a life skill, and I think that's something that we, even as adults, struggle, as we were just saying.
Well, it's interesting. So I don't know if I said a few months ago, I got rid of all the social apps on my phone, and that's the only way I can stop myself checking it obsessively. I have to remove, and every now and again I'll add it on for a day at a weekend or something, maybe I'm traveling, I'll put Facebook on, check it out, then I'll delete it again. So 99% of the time I don't have any social apps on my phone at all.
And that's a great strategy, and I know one of my children has done that too, or they do only the social media apps on the computer that are not as friendly as on the. So yeah, I think, you know, those are great strategies. And there's a great organization out of, I'm going to give a plug to them, a Tactical Technology Collective. They're out of Berlin. They do phenomenal work about detox from your phone, detox from your laptop. And they're a nonprofit. And they also do The Glass Room. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a traveling show. And it basically shows you how much of your life is being tracked and what are some things that you can do and what is happening to that information, and how when you go online, you're actually getting a curated experience, this idea that you don't really have free will on the internet. Everything is kind of selected based on your predicted behavior that's aggregated by AI, so you're delivered certain things and some things you don't get to see, this idea of the filter bubble. But Tactical Technology Collective, fantastic lessons up there. And I have a Facebook group, and I know Dan is part of it, and we always make sure we put a lot of stuff up there.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. Do you want to just give the name of your Facebook group so people can find it?
Yeah, it's just the Educational Technology Leaders Digital Coach Facebook group, and we are about 2,000 people, international school people, that are working in digital technology and IT directors and digital coaches. And we share every day just tips and articles, and it's just a great place to come and ask questions and also get resources.
Good. So here's a question, John. Let's see if we agree or disagree on this. Do you think coding should be a compulsory subject in schools for certain grades?
I think it should be a compulsory for early grades as a way for exposure, to get everybody to understand how it works and that this is how things run.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be compulsory all the way up to grade 12. But I think kids need to understand the language that is running their life.
Yeah, I'm thinking more or less in agreement, actually. I think, I'm not sure how many years it should be. I mean, obviously there's a limited amount of subjects, but I mean, if you don't understand at least the basics of how operating systems work, how networks work, and how computer code works, like, basically, it might as well be magic goblins inside your iPad, you know, that's running this. Like,
exactly. And so the question is, as a society, how much do we want to be critical thinkers and participants in this? Or do we want to just sit on the sideline and just take it all in and say, oh, wow, this is magic, like you said. So I think it's important that definitely in the younger grades, you know, with Scratch and some of the more interactive, and there are a lot of great robot kits. Just get kids excited and understand there's a logic and there's a language, and then exposure in middle school, and then have, you know, if you want to do computer programming, go down this track, here's some computer programming classes. But I think the big thing is it's become kind of a mystery, and we're just doing we do this thing called Digital Bites, which is a bi-monthly newsletter for our faculty, and we're doing a whole thing about passwords, phishing emails, VPN security at home, you know, don't go on Wi-Fi at the airport and do banking, get your VPN up and running, all that kind of stuff, which is critical because there is this whole world of hackers and you know, there's a big crime world out there that's profiting from our kind of often, you know, innocence or lack of understanding. And you know, you hear all these stories, people's accounts have been taken over, et cetera. I don't want to make it too dramatic, but that's something we're understanding, is that we as educators, and my role as an IT director and the digital coaches and the library team that we work with together, this is something we feel we have to make sure we're giving those resources and that support to teachers.
I mean, I would take the opposite opinion to you. You know, you say you don't want to make it too dramatic. I mean, I'm interested in this topic of security because I've been to DEF CON and things, and I think people should be 10 times more scared than they really are. If they knew how much data is really getting hacked, I think they'd be freaking out.
Well, we know that because what's interesting, Olivier, my IT manager, basically brought out all the statistics of how many tens of thousands of hacks and attempts we get every day. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. And, you know, we actually had a penetration test with a company in London, Nine, and it was just shocking how quickly they were able to get into things. And we realized that even though we had what I would consider a decent, robust, we realized we really had to up the ante. And it's not just upping the ante, it's staying on top of it and always making sure you're monitoring and keeping to date. I agree with you. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people in their homes, they're just targets because they're the way they set things up or they do their banking at the airport, whatever it might
be. I would put out one tip for everyone, one basic cybersecurity tip for everyone on this podcast. You mentioned the VPN. That's obviously a great one. I use two-factor authentication for everything. Anywhere you can enable it, for my Facebook account, for my Google account, which basically, and there's different ways. So what that means is you get a code either via an SMS, and so somebody would have to have, not only would they have to know your password, but they'd have to have your phone as well.
Now, exactly.
Most you can take the code via an SMS or a text, but that's kind of, you can spoof that fairly easily. Much better way, download the Google Authenticator app, and you can, most of these systems, websites that have two-factor authentication, they integrate with Google. You download the Google Authenticator app, and that generates a secure code, and it's way more secure than getting the text message. So that's just a tip I'd throw out there for people.
Yeah, and I think some things now are you get the text message, and then you click on a picture, and it generates another one that my bank just started doing.
Yeah.
The two-step authentication, I can't agree with you more. That's just it's almost a non-negotiable.
You'd be amazed how many people, I do it all the time, and people are like, what are you doing? What's Google Authenticator? And I'm like, don't you use Google Authenticator?
What I hear often, it's such a hassle. I'm just going to turn it off.
Yeah.
I don't like, I want to bank straight away. The other thing now that we're talking about this is where does this come into the curriculum? Because kids, you know, they go to university, they buy things online, you know. So the question is, do these then become part of the critical, kind of the essential curriculum, as much as reading and writing and mathematics and data analysis? And I think that's the challenge, and trying to get people to understand that this is not going to go away. And as you said, the security issue and being able to kind of, you know, navigate all this is, you know, I think at some level we need to be teaching kids to at least give them a baseline, you know, good passwords and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not a full subject, but it's definitely something you could have certain lessons in computer science or maybe just in a regular kind of ethics class, and, you know, you could have this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So no, it's an interesting time for all that.
Definitely. You mentioned a couple of resources. Any other resources you want to give? Obviously, if you think of some afterwards, you can send me them. I'll put them in the show notes.
Well, I think, you know, most people that are listening know the Common Sense Media, Digital Citizenship. They do fantastic stuff. Tactical Technology Collective out of Berlin. I really highly recommend them. There's another group called DQ Institute out of Singapore, and they do the Digital Intelligences Framework, and they're working with the OECD and the World Bank, and they have some wonderful resources, I think, that, you know, really are quite interesting. The Canadian Media Literacy Organization has some good stuff out of the UK. There are a lot of organizations doing things. You know, I think it's not a matter of resources. I think it's more about how do you engage school leaders, school educators, parents, to work together to create something where you feel you're arming or giving people the tools and the knowledge so at least they're navigating this with some sense of self-confidence and don't often feel disarmed or kind of like, oh my God, this is all too overwhelming.
Yeah.
It should be overwhelming. And I think we have let it become overwhelming because we have not really broken it down for people and say, here's some basics. Here's some things that we all can, like the two-step authentication. You know, everybody should know that. What are we doing to make sure everybody knows how to do that?
But you know, but here's the other thing which doesn't get talked about, how I see it is, people focus on mitigating the negatives. How do we stop children spending too much time on their device? How do we stop them, you know, doing stupid security flaws and getting hacked? How do we stop them sharing inappropriate content and getting into trouble? And that's, I mean, there's a place for that. But there's another side less talked about, which is, you know, these tools, you can create a whole world, business, life that didn't exist. I mean, I'll just take myself, you know, just, I mean, I run apps events, we run Google training all around the world. I've done a bunch of other stuff online, you know, this podcast, blogs, social media stuff, you know, online training, all sorts of great things. Like, I've used all these tools. I've tried as much as I can not to be a victim. And I've now created this thing where, you know, I get to work with cool people like John all around the world because of these tools. So I think you have to also tell kids, look, there's a huge opportunity here. Don't be the guy who gets sold to online. Be the guy who uses the internet to make you money, you know?
Yeah, make you money and or for the good, you know, yeah. NGO or something like that. Absolutely. Well,
everything. I mean, yeah, we do a lot of nonprofit stuff, and we wouldn't be able to get anything out like we do without the internet, you know?
I agree. It's so empowering. And, you know, it's funny. The other day I have an anecdote. Some educator comes to me and says, well, I have all these laptops in the room and the kids are really misbehaving. Do you have some software that can block them? And I was like, no, it's about behavior. It has nothing to do with the laptops.
Definitely.
They're just the vehicle. And you know, so the answer was, well, we're not going to have laptops.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a tough one.
Yeah, and I think it is about, and you know, changing behaviors and mindsets is a very challenging and complex thing. And humans are complex and they're amazing. And I think we just need to understand that kind of work takes a lot of effort and it has to be in small pieces. And you really have to differentiate. It's a challenge. And I think we cannot let that go.
Yeah, and the other thing to stress, yeah, I completely agree. On the positive is, I do a session at our events about entrepreneurship for students, which I've just revamped the whole thing. And that really stresses that, look, children can get going, they can be 12, 13, 14, nobody knows on the internet. They can be running a project that gets worldwide attention. They can be running a business even. They can do all kinds of things. I mean, there's tons of kids contributing to open source software projects, you know, which and that's, in the coding world, that's how you build your CV nowadays. You contribute to a bunch of open source projects, you get a name for yourself, and then companies want to hire you, you know? So there's a whole thing, you know, range of things which we couldn't do when we were in school, but they can now, you know?
But the important thing is if we just let them go and do that and we're not part of that conversation about what does it make, what are some good ethics? What are some good yeah. beliefs? What's a good strategic vision? How do you make sure you're empathetic to the multicultural environment you're about to launch your product?
Definitely.
All that, that has nothing to do with technology, but we have to somehow be able to frame it and engage ourselves as schools and educators to put those things together and say, we're going to do that part and you're going to go and build your YouTube channel or your startup, but we're going to have this very tight collaboration to ensure there's this balance and that we're not creating a world where everybody is, making startups, but there's no ethical bone to it.
Yes, that's definitely the place for schools. I 100% agree. It's interesting, you know, because... And this is a whole, we could have a whole other podcast on this topic.
We're almost going into another topic here, Dan.
Yeah. I know, we're almost up to it. You know what? I'm going to hold my thought for the next conversation. I'm not going to say what I was going to say. If you're interested to find out what it was, drop me an email or comment on the podcast. John, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. We've gone half an hour over the time, but it's been great as always. And thanks very much for coming on. Is there anything you want to share? Anything else apart from the Facebook group?
No, I think just, you know, I think digital citizenship is a huge issue. And I think, you know, we as a community of educators need to support each other. Nobody has all the answers. And I think a lot of, you know, conferences and groups like the Facebook group or Twitter, however you can leverage, you know, your own knowledge and share it out. And I think, you know, understand that for teachers, it's something that's a challenge, and we as digital coaches and as IT leaders and school leaders need to make sure we're providing the right venues and the right support to make sure that everybody feels at least empowered to engage with these issues that are not going to go away, and they're complex and they're not easy to deal with. And it's the parent, teacher, school, we need to kind of, you know, make that a group that works closely together.
You know, I often wonder in closing, if you look at how a lot of adults behave on Twitter and Facebook, how like this crazy polarization, attacking anyone who disagrees with you, I wonder if it's like, if the next generation isn't going to be like that because they've hopefully been educated via this kind of digital citizenship stuff not to behave like that online. I really hope so.
I hope so too, and we have a lot of work to do to change bad habits then.
Great. Cheers, John. All the best.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you, Dan.